my talk continues to follow this handout. And again, what we've done so far is why do I care, and a tiny bit of the inspiration. So this invariant, I'm going to do a little bit more of the inspiration and then get into the real things. And then the last few pages are computations. So that's it. So I think we were in slide 18, so let's go there. And I have a few more comments about, so I, just before the break, I presented this invariant of from tangles into diagrams, and I said a few, just defined it without constructing it. The construction is very, very hard. But I wanted to say a few more things about it. First of all, you know, it looks completely ad hoc, but in fact, it's sort of God-given. It's absolutely natural. Namely, so there is a certain procedure of completing the space of tangles, and it's essentially exactly what Richard told us yesterday. So you somehow look at the augmentation ideal and look at powers of the augmentation ideal and mod out by those powers and take. So there is a completely standard procedure of completing the space of tangles. And then there is also the associated graded of this completion. And you can show that this is the associated graded of the completion. And this map is an expansion also in the sense of yesterday. So it's really a map between this completion, it's an isomorphism of this completion with its associated graded, which respects all the available operations, so which is homomorphic, hence the name homomorphic expansion. So it's completely natural. It's sort of, you would be curious if it exists on a priori grounds. Okay? Automatically you should be curious whether such a thing exists or not, and the answer is that it does. I mean, it would take you some time to analyze the associated graded and find that this is this, but there is nothing arbitrary here. It's completely natural. So that's the first point. The second point is, so the names here, bracket and co-bracket, suggested some relationship with Lie algebras, and I wanted to say very briefly what is this relationship. So, very briefly, so a Lie bialgebra G is some vector space along with a bracket which satisfies some axioms, so anti-symmetry and the Jacobi identity, and a co-bracket. So a co-bracket is just somehow the dual of the bracket, so it goes from G into G tensor G, and it satisfies some axioms, so co-antisymmetry, so antisymmetry in the cosense, and co-Jacobi, and then there is some compatibility between the two. It doesn't matter what it is, okay? But it's written down in many places. So that's a Lie bialgebra. Now, I claim that a diagram like this represents or is a universal formula. It's a formula that has a meaning in every Lie bialgebra. So in every Lie bialgebra, a diagram like this, so given G, a diagram like this becomes an element in the universal enveloping algebra of that Lie bialgebra raised to the tensor power the number of strands. And how does it work? So basically, you interpret an arrow as the identity map. So the identity map is a tensor in G dual tensor G. So you just interpret, that's the meaning of an arrow. You interpret this, the bracket vertex. So the bracket vertex is by the same laws where I interpret the tail of an arrow as an element of G dual or as a tensor factor in G dual. So this will be another G dual and this will be a head of an arrow, so it corresponds to G. So this will be a tensor in G dual tensor G dual tensor G, which means a homomorphism from G tensor G into G. And this homomorphism will be, or will be interpreted as the bracket. And likewise, the co-bracket vertex is a homomorphism from G into G dual tensor, sorry, into G tensor G. And this is to be interpreted as the co-bracket delta. And then, and finally, red strands are to be interpreted as, oops, sorry, I lied to you. It's really the universal enveloping algebra of the double of G, where the double of G is G dual sum G with some bracket which you get by using the bracket of G to make a bracket on this part, and the bracket of the co-bracket to make a bracket on this side, and the co-adjoint action linking, or the adjoint action linking these two parts. So there is some Lie algebra called the double of G, and when I wrote here the universal enveloping algebra, I meant the universal enveloping algebra of the double. And then along every red strand, so I'm not sure if I have a red colored chalk, you know, this strand here is red. Then along every red strand, you're going to see some arrow tails and arrow heads. So like here, head, head, tail, tail. And you're going to interpret the heads as elements of G, as elements in G, the tails as elements in G dual, and then you just multiply them in the universal enveloping algebra. So whenever you connect pieces of diagram, you contract the corresponding tensors. So a diagram like this really represents an element in, well, one universal enveloping algebra for each tensor, for each red strand, and then and you get an element in this tensor product of universal enveloping algebras, and it is constructed by contracting identities and brackets and co-brackets as specified by the diagram. And then you can show that these relations are precisely correspond to the relations of a Lie algebra. Yes?
Can you make a space smaller by assuming there are no graphs with closed paths? So because it's,
yes,
kind of a finite dimensional
image. Yes, so I'm somewhat loose here, and the space has two variants. A variant where you allow cycles, like here, and a variant where you do not allow cycles of black things. And in fact, and there is some distinction between the two, and rather than telling what is the distinction, I think I prefer to this remains a schematic.
But it works.
It works, yes. With some small print, so of about which of the variants you need to use when. But again, since this is just for inspiration, I prefer not to give details. Okay? So really, this is somehow related to Lie algebras. Okay. Okay. So this looks lovely. We have a homomorphic invariant. We have an invariant which has which is homomorphic with respect to the stitching operation, and this is exactly what we wanted, right? The only problem is that it's horrible. So this space of diagrams is impossible to work with, and not only in the mechanical sense, but also in some computational complexity sense. The number of such diagrams grows extremely quickly. Well, I should have said that this space is graded. It's graded basically by half the number of vertices. So these are trivalent, so the number of vertices is always equal. So it grows really, really quickly in the degree. So you know, even if it wasn't mechanically complicated to work with, it would still be impossible because the size would be huge. Okay? So it's lovely, but way too hard. And then the idea, and I've had this idea many years ago, I mean, I thought about it first time long, long ago, but the idea was to look for quotients of this space which are somehow ideals. So, right, if you have a ring, an ideal is in a ring is what you mod out by so that the ring operation remains well defined. So, here it should be an ideal relative to the stitching operation. You should mod out by things that do not ruin the stitching, so that stitching remains well defined. And so again, I'm not specific what it means, what exactly it means, but you have to think of ideal quotients of this space that will make it much smaller and hopefully computable, so hopefully polynomial sized, and then do computations. So, but you see, these ideals don't necessarily have to be related to Lie algebras. So one way of getting such ideals is to pick a specific tensor map, pick a specific Lie algebra, consider the corresponding tensor map, and then the kernel of that tensor map, so basically the collection of all diagrams that are not seen by some specific Lie algebra, would form an ideal. And then you could mod out by these ideals, but that would give you just the sort of classical quantum algebra. So you will not gain anything because classical quantum algebra is always exponential time. So the idea is to look for ideals that don't necessarily come from Lie algebras. As it turns out, I ended up finding ideals that at first I thought do not come from Lie algebras, but then I realized actually should be understood as the ideals coming from Lie algebras, but Lie algebras that nobody considered before. At least not in this context. And the things you do with them are things that people don't usually do. Okay? So again, I'm looking for quotients. And then the first kind of relations that I could mod out by are the one co and two co relations, or the tails commute and tails commute squared relations. So the one co relation says, let's kill all the co brackets. So if you have a co bracket anywhere in the diagram, you set it to be zero. So, in Lie theory, it corresponds to saying, let's talk about co-commutative Lie by algebras. So, the co-bracket delta is equal to zero. And alternatively, well, since by this STU relation, this corresponds to, this corresponds to basically setting the right hand side to be zero corresponds to setting this to zero, which says that basically you can commute tails across each other. So I call it also the tails commute relation. And not theoretically, it also has a meaning. It corresponds to some not theoretic relation, which at the end amounts to saying that you're talking about two-dimensional surfaces knotted in R4. Okay? But this is a story I spent several years studying, and in fact the first time I thought about it was when Anton came to the Fields Institute and we talked for 10 minutes on the blackboard there, and sort of the results of that conversation is what we're talking about now. But basically what happens is if you mod out by no co-bracket vertices, then the only thing you can still draw are trees made out of bracket vertices and wheels in which you cycle in one direction and all other vertices, sort of all other things are incoming into this wheel. So you're left with a relatively manageable space. So wheels and trees, which are still modeled out by a Jacobi relation, so this is really the Frehley algebra and cyclic words. And the theory that this boils down to is this Alexeyev-Torossian theory that revolves around the Kashiwara-Verne, etc. And there is a series of papers by myself and Giuliana Dancio about all of this, and I don't want to talk about it because that's done. Okay? The two correlation would say, okay, so let's relax the one correlation a bit. Let's say, if you have one co-bracket, it's still good. But if you have two co-brackets in a diagram, then you set it to be zero. Okay? So you can say it's artificial. Maybe it's artificial, but I did spend a long time looking at many relations and trying to figure out which ones we work, and this seems the closest to work. So it's kind of one up from this Alexeyev-Torossian story. And now you can draw a few more diagrams. So you can draw five more to a total of seven. And it's still, the story can still be formulated somehow in terms of Frehley algebras and cyclic words, but it's more complicated. And I haven't actually really done this. And one reason is because, well, it's theoretically manageable, but it gets very, very complicated. And in any case, it's still exponential time. Because, I mean, even the Frehley algebra, even cyclic words, are exponentially many of them. So this is still exponential time. Okay. The next idea is to take something from Lie algebras, meaning take a relation from Lie algebras, but take it along with the relation we already have, so the two correlation. Okay? So the next thing I say is, let's declare, or let's pretend, that we work with diagrams that describe two-dimensional Lie algebras. Now, a two-dimensional Lie algebra has the property, so again, by the way, G is two-dimensional, so the double of G will be four-dimensional. Okay, but the Lie algebra I work with is two-dimensional. So two-dimensional Lie algebras have the property that wedge squared of G is equal to the scalars. So if you have any two tensors, A and B, in wedge squared of G, then they have to be proportional. Okay? So, diagrammatically, this means that if you take anything, whatever, any diagram you wish, which has two input lines and two output lines, and you anti-symmetrize here, and you anti-symmetrize here, anyway, so if you take any one such diagram, and any other such diagram, they must be proportional to each other. Or rather, if you will look at the corresponding tensors, so these diagrams represent tensors using the construction before, and then these tensors will be proportional. So, let's mod out by the relation saying this is equal to this. And then, well, I mean, making some choices to make the proportionality constant 1. So let's mod out by this is equal to this for some specific diagrams, and this is the parallel of saying we're working with two-dimensional Lie algebras. And then that ends up corresponding to the three relations written here. So this relation, which is the only relation which makes sense in zero core because it involves no core brackets, only brackets. So this relation, and if you mod out by this relation, you get the gold standard, the theory I described before. And then the further, sorry, if you mod out by these relations and by one core, so you restrict your attention to the co-commutative case. And then there are these two further relations that you can mod out by, this one and that one, and these should somehow correspond to, if you mod out by these relations without modding by the one core relation, then you're just saying that the Lie algebra is two-dimensional, which really corresponds to SL2. The Lie algebra corresponding to SL2 is two-dimensional. So you're like saying the Jones polynomial in all possible representations. So the idea is to mod out by both these relations, which say Jones polynomial, and the two-core relation. So no, you allow only one core bracket, and then see what remains. And now I'm getting really, really sketchy because again this was only inspiration. Okay. So the claim is that when you mod out by these two relations, the resulting thing is polynomial time. And in fact, this I knew and could prove already a year ago, but it's polynomial time, yet very, very complicated, and I could never really implement it. So let me explain very briefly why it's polynomial time and also why I couldn't implement it. Okay? So why is it polynomial time? Because once you mod out by these relations, okay? And you've already modded out by these ones. So you only have these diagrams, but you also have relations that allow you to basically trade brackets to blobs. Okay? So you can just trace what you get when you start from these relations and trace bracket and trade brackets into blobs, and you find that you get only, what is it, seven diagrams, six diagrams, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven diagrams. Okay? There are only seven things to consider. And these are, so after you modded out by these relations. So you get a relatively small space of things. However, the ends of these things that you get, so you get diagrams that are only look like a blob with an arrow coming out or just an arrow, but these arrows are still labeled by which strands they connect to. And if you have n strands, then this really could stand for n squared diagrams, because the tail could be on any one of the strands and the head could be on any one of the strands. And likewise, this one could stand for n to the 4 strands. Sorry, n to the 4 diagrams. So really, this is a space whose dimension is roughly n to the 4. So n to the 4 is a small number. It's still a space of polynomial size. So you can expect that whatever operations you do to it will only take polynomial amount of time. And in fact, you can make this precise and find a solution to the Young-Baxter equation. And in fact, here it is written down explicitly. But it's still very complicated. You still have to manage seven different things and figure out how they relate. And once I start telling you the details of how they could relate, you'll find that it's really, really complicated. So I was stuck on that for about a year. Okay? So really the problem remains how to multiply in this space and how to stitch. And I think I want to switch gears. Is this okay? Okay? So, I don't know why I decided to show this slide again when I was setting it up, but here it is again. So I suppose what I'm going to say is that at the end I do work with Lie algebras. But yeah, let's just switch to the Lie algebras. Okay? So let me first define the Lie algebras, and then tell you where they came from, and then tell you how what I do with them. And what I do with them is, well, okay, we'll see. So let G1 be the four-dimensional Lie algebra. So G1 in the language of this blackboard is DG. It's the double of something two-dimensional. So it's the four-dimensional Lie algebra with four generators, B, C, U, and W. And it's an algebra over a ring. And the ring is polynomials in epsilon, but epsilon squared is equal to zero. So if you wish, it's really an eight-dimensional algebra over the rationals. Okay? And it's defined by the commutation relations that B is central, and then W and C and C and U behave like in SL2, I've already mentioned. So WC is W, C and U is U. And then the bracket of U and W is mostly central, but it has an epsilon part proportional to C. Okay?
Does it have this invariant scalar product?
Does it have an invariant scalar product? I probably yes. Yes, I would think it. Wait. Well, it has a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation, and that's what I'm going to write next. And yes, I think it has an invariant scalar product. Furthermore, so this Lie algebra has a thing that replaces the arrow. Okay, so the arrow is supposed to satisfy some relations, and these relations amount to the so-called classical Young-Baxter equation. And since maybe I should have written it down and explained why it's related. But is it really necessary? It's actually not really necessary for what I'm going to tell you. So I'll just state that there is a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation in it, and you'll see what I do with it. I don't really need it. I don't need it directly. So, or more precisely, so, you know, these theorems of Etting of Kashdan and Rikas and Shevera say that whenever you have a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation, there exists a solution of the Young-Baxter equation, meaning Rademeister 3, meaning there are not invariants, or potential not invariants. And so the theorems say that this Young-Baxter solution exists, but they don't tell you how to write it. So in fact, the way I write it is I guess it. So in some sense, knowing that there is a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation is only good for inspiration. It's not really good for doing anything. Okay? Anyway, there is a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation, and here it is. Now, I should also say, and again, I don't know what to do with this statement. I'm only making it for your entertainment. Okay? So, over the rationals, G1 is somehow a solvable approximation of SL2. I already mentioned it. So the fact that it's approximates SL2 is kind of clear from the relations. The fact that it's solvable, well, here is a tower of subalgebras written here, such that the quotients, the successive quotients are abelian. So that's the algebra I will work with. Now, I don't know, maybe I was too,
Sorry, stupid question. What do the indices mean? How for instance, is B related to BI or?
So this is general notation.
Huh.
So, in general, I work in spaces that look like the universal enveloping algebra to the nth power. And then, when I want to write one tensor, tensor x, tensor 1,
uh-huh.
And the x is in position
right.
I simply write xi.
Thank you.
Okay? So when I write so if I write something like b1 c2 plus u1 w2, which is essentially what I wrote here with one term dropped for simplicity, this really means I live in the second tensor power, and what I've written is, so B is on the first tensor factor, U is on the first tensor factor, so it's B tensor C, sorry, C is on the second tensor factor, plus U tensor W. Okay? So,
this is one.
So this is just sort of a keystroke saving device for saying R. Well, okay, I mean I dropped the term. Okay? Okay, this will be extremely useful later on. Okay. You know, this is me being overly ambitious, okay? So, in a certain sense, it's more valuable than SL2. Well, I don't know, this is maybe too. But the sense is, things that you do in this algebra, you finish in your lifetime. Okay? Things are really computable. Okay, so this algebra is a deformation of zero Smijian SL2. So zero Smijian SL2 is the same thing, but you set epsilon to be equal to zero. So you get the same BCUW, and then B remains central, and you also have that the same relations as before, but the bracket of U and W is just B, instead of being B minus 2 epsilon C, it's just B because I've set epsilon to be equal to zero. And the R matrix becomes what I wrote over there. So the R matrix on the lowercase R matrix, the classical Young-Baxter, if you put it on tensor factors I and j, is BICJ plus UIWJ. And maybe I should tell you where it came from, but even before that, so in some sense, it is even more valuable than G1, this G0, because it's even easier to compute in it. But the problem is that almost everything you can get out of it, we've already gotten by other means. So 90 years ago, when the Alexander polynomial was first written, so hence we work with the slightly less valuable G1. Anyway, where did these Lie algebras come from? So, in some sense, they came from SL2, but by forgetting most of SL2. So, one way of writing SL2 is to say that SL2 is its upper Borel subalgebra, so the sort of diagonal and upper and the things above the diagonal, plus its lower Borel subalgebra, so the diagonals plus the things below the diagonal. But if you take the sum of these two, you get an extra Cartan factor. You get the Cartan factor Cartan factor twice. So you have to mod out by one Cartan factor. So SF2 is B plus plus B minus divided by H. I'll just write it as SL2 plus divided by H, where SL2 plus is SL2 with an extra Cartan factor. So SL2 plus is the algebra I really care about, not SL2. Okay? Now, the upper Borel of SL2 plus, or the upper Borel of SL2, is a two-dimensional algebra. So in classical notation, it's just H and E, I think. Okay, or maybe H and F, I'm not sure which one is upper and which one is lower. So it's a two-dimensional non-abelian Lie algebra, and there is only one two-dimensional non-commutative Lie algebra, so I don't even need to tell you which one it is. So B plus is this two-dimensional Lie algebra, but I use slightly different notation, so it's a two-dimensional Lie algebra generated by C and W, where you see, should be thinking of C as being the Cartan, and W as being the E or F. So the bracket of W and C is W. And then, since the upper Borel and lower Borel are dual, this means that the dual of B plus is again a Lie algebra. Or in other words, B plus is a Lie bi-algebra, so it must have a co-bracket. And the co-bracket is this map delta from B plus to B plus tensor B plus, and it's given by, well, the co-bracket of C is equal to 0, the co-bracket of W is C wedge W. And this fully specifies SL2 in two-dimensional terms. Namely, SL2, or more precisely, SL2 plus. So SL2 plus is the double of this Lie bi-algebra, meaning it's the dual of this Lie bi-algebra direct sum, not tensor, sorry, direct sum itself, and that's a four-dimensional Lie algebra, where the basis is C and W, as before, and the dual basis B and U. Okay? And you can write the commutation relations explicitly. Okay? And then the idea, and again it's inspired by this one, 0 co, 2 co, the idea is to say, if you have twice the co bracket, it's 0. So, or in fact in general you can say, if you have a certain power of the co bracket is equal to 0. So, replace the co bracket by epsilon times the co bracket, where epsilon is a variable whose k plus first power is equal to 0. So now we're working over a new ring, and this is the ring we're working at. So at k equals 0, you can just trace it and you get the 0 Smigian Lie algebra, so this one. So basically you've killed the co-bracket, you're left with almost nothing of SL2, just its upper Borel and something abelian that you add to it, and that's 0 Smigian. At k equals 1, the relations you get are written right here, and they are not quite the relations of 1 Smigian SL2. However, if you look at these relations for a little bit, so these are the relations you actually get, and if you look at them for just a little bit, you find that B prime plus epsilon C, oh sorry, temporarily I've decided to name B, B prime. Okay? So if you stare at these relations for just a little bit, you find that B prime is central. Sorry, B prime plus epsilon C is central. And central is good. If you have a central element in a Lie algebra, it means that you can pull it out of all formulas. You can really think of it as a coefficient. You can really almost think of it as if it's a part of the coefficient ring. Okay? So it's good to have a compact name for central elements. So change variable to B equals B prime plus epsilon C, and then you get G1. So in other words, what I'm saying is that what you get here is G1, but the basis is not quite the same basis. If you make this change of variables, you come to the basis, to the relations I wrote before. Okay? And that also explains the CHIBE, the solution of the classical Young-Baxter. Right? The solution of the classical Young-Baxter is always the basis paired with its dual. So it's always this formula, but since I changed variables, it becomes the formula I wrote before. Okay? So my goal is to compute sort of quantum invariance for this Lie algebra G1. But as a warm-up, and the warm-up contains almost all the information, let me compute quantum invariance for G0. So, you know, sort of saying that it contains almost all the information is a bit retrospective. So the G0 computations I could do years ago, but not in the language that I'm going to do it right now. It's in the language which I'm using now that it contains all the information. Okay. So again, forget G1 temporarily and think only about G0. And G0 is a rather simple-minded Lie algebra. It's the Lie algebra generated by, you know what, I think I wrote it, so let me just repeat it. So it's the Lie algebra with four generators, B, C, U, and W, but it's really a coefficient, so something central, and then three-dimensional interesting stuff. And the three-dimensional interesting stuff is more or less a Heisenberg algebra. So,
if I understand correctly, it's more like U, W, and B, which is Heisenberg, and
yes.
C.
Yeah. It's U and W, sorry, U, W, and B form a Heisenberg algebra, and C is something additional.
Is a derivation which acts.
Yes. So, so basically, the bracket of U and W is a scalar, or the central thing, that's the Heisenberg. And then C is, you know, a number operator, if you wish, which counts the U's and minus counts the W's. Okay. The zero, so the CHIBE, the classical Young-Baxter, the solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation for this Lie algebra is just the identity element of B dual tensor B. So I think I wrote it before. It's B1 C2 plus U1 W2. Yeah. And generally speaking, if you want the solution of Young-Baxter out of this, well, it's complicated. It's deformation quantization. But in this specific case, in the specific, but by luck, for this Lie algebra, and in general for all co-commutative Lie algebras, the exponential of that is a solution, so call it uppercase R12, and it's a solution of Young-Baxter equation, of the Young-Baxter equation. So it satisfies the relations, essentially the Rademeister 3 relation. So this is what's written here. So Rij is the exponential of lowercase Rij, which is the exponential of this identity element, which is in itself, it's an element of the universal enveloping algebra of this of this Lie algebra G0 in component I and another one in component J. And to be fair, it should be the completed universal enveloping algebra, and in order to complete it I should give you a grading, and I failed to write the grading, but the grading is elements of B minus have degree 1 and elements of B plus have degree 0. So the degree of B is equal to 0, the degree of C and W is 0, and the degree of B and U is 1. So this is something of degree 1, and so exponentiation makes sense. I mean, it converges. Okay. And then, one way to visualize this Rij is to think of it as this, you have two strands on which you deposit elements of the universal enveloping algebra, and the orange box means deposit elements of the universal enveloping algebras, the algebra as written here. So in other words, you're going to deposit B's and U's here, and C's and W's here, right? Because the B's and the U's live on strand I, and C's and W's live on strand J. So we're going to deposit B's and U's here, and C's and W's here, with coefficients, so basically, with whatever coefficients come out when you expand this as a power series. Okay? And then, if you think of this as the value of a positive crossing between strand I and J, where strand I is over strand J, then the claim is that it will satisfy the Rademacher 3 rule. And so out of this, you can get an invariant of tangles. And how does it work? So suppose you have a complicated tangle. Well, this is not so complicated. It's almost the simplest tangle you can write with three crossings. So one strand goes like this, the other strand goes like this, and then the recipe tells us that at every crossing, we're going to deposit along each of these strands a bunch of U's and V's, and U's and W's and B's and C's, as dictated by Rij, in the following manner. So, corresponding to this crossing, we're going to deposit B's and U's here, and C's and W's here. Corresponding to this crossing, we're going to deposit B's and U's here, and C's and W's here, and finally for this one. Actually, this one is a negative crossing, so we're going to have to use the inverse of that. So, the negative exponential. And then, you basically stretch these strands to be lines. And so you see, if I go along strand number 1, I see the deposit area 1, and then deposit area 2. So this is deposit area 1 and deposit area 2. This is where various U's and V's and W's were placed. And if I go along the strand Y, sorry, I think I call them X and Y. So if I go along strand Y, I see deposit area 3, then deposit area 4, then deposit area 5 and 6. So 3, 4, 5 and 6. And in each place, I have a big deposit of U's and W's and V's and whatever. Sorry, no V's. U's and W's and C's and B's. Whatever. And you know, you can actually read off what it was that was deposited from this picture. So an arrow means that this is where, this is the bidule side. The tail of the arrow is the bidule side, and the head of the arrow is the B side. So here you deposit B's and U's, and here you deposit C's and W's, and this sort of, they're connected because they come from the same exponential. Anyway, the results of this is a big sum of things deposited on strands. And you should think of these as little beads, which are corresponding to C and U and W, and they are various colors. And B is sort of central, so I made it thin. You can sort of go through it. It slides with it commutes with everything. And this is the invariant. That's it. It's the only problem. Yeah.
Is it like a Kaufman-Rapford invariant?
I think it is.
Yeah, well,
but I'm not good with names.
They do it just for quantum groups.
This is all classical. There's nothing new about it. What's new about it is the algebras I use and the ways I'm going to compute with them. But sort of this particular piece is classical. Okay? But let me say something that it's useless, of course. Because these beads are modular relations, right? We're in the universal enveloping algebra, and like if you commute a red bead with a blue bead, there is some price that you pay, but just looking at the beads, it's not an invariant thing, it's an invariant in a quotient space. So as it is, it's useless, and you have to somehow extract information out of it. The classical quantum algebra information, way to extract information is to choose a representation of the Lie algebra. So you choose a representation and then you represent this, you represent that. You either take the trace or you look at matrix elements of the representation, but somehow you extract information out of representation theory. The Lie algebras I work with don't have a good representation theory. So at least I don't know a good representation theory for it. And in fact, even if they had a good representation theory, I would avoid it. Because representation theory is completely contradictory to my goals. Right? In representation theory, at the end, you get one representation factor per strand. And then you have to take the tensor product of these representations. Tensor products, tensor powers, means exponential size, meaning I will never be able to compute anything. Okay? So instead, I do the most straightforward thing, except in general, it doesn't work, and here it doesn't. It does. So the most straightforward thing is to just switch to a PBW basis. So I choose an ordering of the basis element. So say I choose the cow ordering. So CUW. Okay? Which means that I want red things to come first, then green, then blue. So I take this thing, and I want to sort it so that reds are at the bottom, green are above it and blue are above. And then, of course, this I wrote as an elongated red because it could be a number of reds. And this is an elongated green because, again, it could be a number of greens. So basically, I want to take this thing and I want to write it as a linear combination of pictures like this, where each one of these is some power of red, or power of green, or power of blue, with coefficients that are, well, I already told you that I'm going to turn the central elements into coefficients, so with coefficients that are functions, well, later I will be specific about what kind of functions, but at the moment, let's just say power series, in the B's, but with rational coefficients. So that's my goal. Okay? And again, this is so obvious. I mean, it's the obvious thing to do. Except for SL2, it's impossible. For SL2, in practice, when you want to sort, when you actually want to apply PBW in SL2, you find very quickly that it's impossible. That the formulas are impossible to work with. But with these Lie algebras, it turns out to be possible. Okay, let me make it slightly more formal, and probably I should end with this. Okay, so I'm going to define a sorting, sorry, an ordering operator. So O is so O in general, or blackboard O is well, let me just say what it is. So O is an operation that takes a polynomial, or more generally a power series, in some variables, and then some specifications, and then it places those polynomials inside universal enveloping algebras according to these specifications. So it's a map from the symmetric algebra to a text from some symmetric algebra to some tensor product of universal enveloping algebras, which places symmetric polynomials in a universal enveloping algebra according to some specifications. And maybe the best is if I define it by giving an example. Okay? So, here is an example. So, here is a polynomial. Actually, it's again a power series, not quite a polynomial. So, C1 cubed, U1, W1 squared, C2, E to the U3, I told you it's a power series, W3. So, but you should think of it as a symmetric word. This is a symmetric polynomial, or power series. Things here commute. And here is a specification. The specification says, I am going to place this polynomial on two copies of a universal enveloping algebra, one copy called X and the other copy called Y. On copy X, I will place variables W3 and C1. And so if you look at the variables that appear here, there are C1, U1, W1. So basically, you can count, you can read which variables appear here. So I'm going to put the variables W3 and C1 on copy X of the universal enveloping algebra, and I'm going to put the variables U1, U3, and C2 on copy Y in this order. So these specifications are no longer commutative. The polynomial is commutative, but the specification says how to place it in a non-commutative manner. So this amounts to saying, well, okay, I said there are two copies of the universal enveloping algebra, so here are the two copies. There is UG, one copy labeled X, and another copy labeled Y. So on the first copy, I put W3 and C1. And on the second copy, I put U1, U3, and C2. Now, I should have said that these are polynomials in the generators of my Lie algebra, but taken with several copies. So these are polynomials in the symmetric algebra of several copies of my Lie algebra, where the copies are distinguished by the subscript. So in this case, I believe I took three copies of the Lie algebra. So C1 really means the variable C corresponding to the first copy. W3 means the variable W corresponding to the third copy. And then I place these and then I take these. So what am I told to do? I'm told to place the W3s as the first piece that appears in the first tensor factor here. So I need to take this W3 and put it here, but now it's just a W. right? It's just the generator of this algebra U of G, so it's just a W. Now, then I have to place the C1s. C1 was cubed, so I put here three C's. Okay? Then on the second tensor factor, I put U1, so U1 here appears in the first power, so that just becomes a U here. Then I put U3, U3 appears here exponentiated, so I put E to the U here, and then you can figure out the last one. Okay? So this, so these are what the ordering operators are.
Can W1 didn't appear at all?
Yeah, so this happened to be an O. Oops. There, that's a mistake. A illegal operation.
Should this happen?
I should have put a W1 somewhere here, and then it would appear somewhere here as well. As it is, it's an, you know, maybe it's not so illegal, actually. In fact, that's actually useful, because I will use it later. So in fact, you should think of the unspecified variables as if they remain coefficients. So as if they remain sort of in some symmetric space. So really you should, so this operation really should take values in some symmetric algebra, tensors in universal enveloping algebras, and those variables that I didn't specify remain in the symmetric algebra, and then later I can specify where to put them. So I can compose these operations, and then later I will specify where they would go.
And if you had one that occurred both as an exponential and as a coefficient, like U3 times e to the U3, which one would you take?
Both.
Both.
So if there was a U3 e to the U3, mm-hmm. I would just put here, you know, U3, U e to the U.
So another U from U1, so you'd get U squared?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically it's a, well, you know, this is sort of like normal ordering in quantum field theory, in quantum mechanics, where you have a symmetric polynomial and the normal ordering operator tells you that you take the elements that appear inside it in certain order. Okay? So this is the polynomial, and this is a very fancy way of taking, of specifying in which order you take the elements that appear inside it. And I'm running out of time, so what I'll tell you next time is that, first of all, I will review this, and then I will also tell you that this can be interpreted as a certain polynomial in a very high dimensional, in many copies of the Lie algebras, which is placed along only just two strands. It's kind of obvious, right? Basically, you have, you know, you have initially you have many variables, but you just specify how to place them. And then the big thing will be that I will tell you a bunch of where is it? Here. I will tell you a large collection of rules how to, and it looks impossible to understand, but all of them are meaningful, and some of them are even cute. Okay? And I will tell you a bunch of rules how to reorder. So, in other words, I will tell you, let's go back where we were, I will tell you, if I want to change the ordering here, what operation I need to do to the polynomial appearing here. And these will turn out to be rather simple-minded operations that compose well and make up a computable, and make up, after you sort everything to the CAU form, C-U-W, make up a computable invariant whose computation fits in a small box. This is for G0. For G1, it will be the same, but a bit harder. So that's the plan for next time.
I've got one small question. Is So you explained somewhere in the middle of the talk that you can take those two-dimensional Lie algebras and then say that there is only one coproduct which is allowed, right? This was this two coreduction, right? So one can do these things together. And then you explained that the G1 is a double of the one-dimensional or two-dimensional Lie algebra with the coproduct scaled by epsilon.
Yes. So epsilon squared equal to zero. Yeah. So if you use it twice, you're dead.
Yeah. So this means that this was twice. So G1 is this 2D reduction plus two core.
Yeah.
Okay. Just that was not completely clear.
Yeah.
So this is.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The invariant that you are going to obtain is an element of what kind of space? Is it a polynomial on three variables? Or?
A priori, sorry. A priori, it's a power series. So if you have just a two-component strand, a two-component link tangle, it will be a polynomial. Well, if you have an n-component tangle, it would be a polynomial in four n variables, meaning the b variables, which are central, and then the c, u, and w variables. That's a priori. But but in practice, it will be of a very, very, very restricted form. Or else, I will not know how to compute with it. Sort of. The point is that I somehow find, these rewriting rules, reordering rules that I wrote, are not general. I only reorder things of the kind that I will see. And the things that I will see have a very restricted form, and in fact, it reduces, in the zero co-case, it reduces to a scalar, so something that contains only b's, and it's a rational function in e to the b and b, and after some renormalization, it just becomes a polynomial in e to the b. So it's just a polynomial at the end. And something linear, which I don't want to describe, but it contains no topological information, just linked numbers, and something quadratic. And the quadratic thing, well, quadratic in U's and W's, and that's exactly the matrix part of this gold standard. And for G1, it will be the same, so G1 contains G0. So for G1, it will be the same plus an additional quartic polynomial. And then the content is somehow in this quartic polynomial. Sorry, quartic polynomial with coefficients in arbitrary power series in B. So I think of the B's as scalars. So it's quartic polynomials in a polynomial in C, U, and W, but really an arbitrary polynomial in the B's. So that's that would be the invariant. But hopefully it will become clearer next time. Okay.
Any issues? Thanks again.